M is for the little thing she gave me. Oh, yes, it's our Mother's Day program. Mother's Day is always, it's like a lot of things. It's happy and sad, isn't it? A bit like Christmas. Can be happy and sad. But as a wag said to me one day, he said, it's a free trip around Australia, round the world on Sunday morning. And on this trip, you'll visit Guangzhou Airport, the Somme, Bay of Islands, Marble Bar, all over the place. And you'll get the dinkum oil. Lovely to have your company. G'day, this is Macca.
Good morning, Macca. It's Michael here from Alice Springs.
Hi, Michael. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well indeed. It's a nice crisp morning here in the Alice.
I saw 1 degree the other morning in Alice, so I thought, that's crisp. Fresh.
That'd be spot on. That'd be spot on. Ian, I thought I'd give you a quick call just to enlighten you and your band of followers, who are very, very numerous, as we know, about a trek that we're embarking on today from the Alice. We're bumping out this morning with the Outback Camel Company, led by Andrew Harper, and I know that you know Andrew pretty well, to head from Alice Springs on a walk to Birdsville, supported by the OCC's fabulous pack camel.
Yeah, interesting. Just excuse me, mate. I'm having a trouble with my headphone.
No worries.
So, Michael, tell me this. How many people and how many camels?
So we have 14 camel. We have 10 walkers who are amateur walkers but regular walkers with Andrew. And the camel is and led by Andrew himself and supported by a doctor on the journey as well. So it's going to be a fabulous trek. We're walking for over a month, and we get to Birdsville on about the 10th of June. That's the scheduled date of arrival. And there are, as you know, no tracks, no roads. We're blasting our trail. So we're celebrating 50 years since Rex Alice established the Outback Camel Company in 1976. And Rex, as you know, was a pioneer of using camels to trek across Australia's deserts. Andrew took on the OCC in the year 2000, and since then has been a regular feature on these wonderful, wonderful journeys.
Yeah, so have you done this before, Michael?
I've done lots of walks with Andrew over the years. I've been walking with him for about 15 years on and off. And this is the longest duration I've done on a single trek, but I have done numerous treks in the past.
Uh-huh. Well, you'll have nice cold mornings, and that'll be nice, but hopefully beautiful days.
Well, my wife, as I headed off on Thursday, actually on Friday morning, she said, "Have you got your hottie bottle?" So I hadn't at that stage, so she was very good to remind me.
So will you mostly be walking, or will you ride your camels, or a bit of walking, a bit of riding? What's the story?
It is all walking, Ian. Everything is walking. The camel are used there to support us with all of our gear, our water and our essentials, and obviously our own personal possessions, which are minimalist, as you can imagine. The focus is very much on simplicity and on a wonderful, wonderful journey and a lifetime experience.
Michael, how long have you lived in the Alice?
I actually live in Sydney, Ian. I live in Sydney, and I've been in Sydney for close to 30 years. I grew up in the northwest of Victoria, and it's from there that I found a great love of Australia's outdoors.
Oh, it's wonderful to be out there, especially. I think winter's the best, actually. It's nice in winter, although it can be cold, depending where you are. But the skies are clearer. As Banjo Paterson wrote in his poem about The Man from Snowy River, and it was about the air is sharp as scissors in the lofty Jindabyne. And it's like that in the cold winter. It's clearer. You can see the stars much clearer in the winter, I reckon.
Oh, look, absolutely. I spent a career doing lots and lots of travel and staying in some exotic places all around the world, staying in 5-star hotels, but I much prefer the million-star hotel of the Australian outback.
Good on you, Michael. Great to talk to you, mate. Good luck. Ring us along the way.
Yeah, look, I'll get Andrew to do that. We'll be out there for a month, so I'm sure we'll find the opportunity.
Oh, what a lovely thing to do. Good on you.
Thanks, Ian. Cheers.
Bye. G'day, this is Macca.
Hello, Macca.
G'day.
It's Brad from Edith Vale here. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
That's good, that's good. I've been listening for a long time, actually a very long time. Mm. I remember listening to you when I was a teenager with my grandpa, who was a cook in the army, and we used to cook every Sunday morning.
Right, yeah, it sounds good.
Yep, and now I'm a chef for the last 25 years, run my own restaurant and catering company, and today is Mother's Day, which is like our Super Bowl day.
You go nuts today. You got
I'm just I'm at my restaurant now. Everything's set, ready to go. No staff are in. I'm having a quiet coffee before the
that's what we're doing here. Storm. Just me and Bree, we're just having a quiet coffee here this morning.
So we've got 200 people booked today for breakfast. And then one of the other sites, another 150 people booked, and
it's mad. It is madness, isn't it? There's a restaurant just down the road from me, and I think they do three sittings. They'd have a sitting at about 11 o'clock till 1, and then 1 till 3, and then 3 till 5, or something like that. And then they do the evening.
It's mental.
It's mental, isn't it? And poor old mothers for the other 364 days of the year, it's just, you know.
Yep, and Mother's Day is always bigger than Father's Day, and what I put it down to is mums are a bit more creative on their presents for dad. Dads are just like, oh, let's just take your mum out for breakfast.
Yeah, let's take mum out for breakfast to get some socks and ties.
And it's always last minute bookings. I'll have people calling, whispering down the phone this morning who have forgotten, going, "Have you got a booking? You got space for us?" Every year, and we make sure we fit all those dads in because I've got three kids myself, so I know exactly what it's like.
Yeah, but, I think it's nice, isn't it? But it is crazy. It's a crazy, crazy day. Same with flowers, I suppose. Everybody be looking for flowers. Oh, Mum, God, you know, it's always a last minute thing because we're so busy in our lives and we're doing tearing around, and then you think, oh, it's Mother's Day. Oh, I haven't got Mum anything or whatever.
But every Sunday morning I listen to you because, just remembering when I was a teenager and I was like a month before I started my formal training, my grandpa passed away. So it's a nice reminder every Sunday morning.
Well, Brady, good luck today, mate. Whereabouts are you?
Edith Vale.
Edith Vale.
And the restaurant's in Morty Alec. So I'll probably get halfway through a beer on the couch this afternoon and then be asleep.
Well, yeah, it is. And it's funny, isn't it, when you're in a restaurant, there's no way, even though, you know, the best organised restaurants, when there's a crowd of people and everybody wants to be served, it's just one little thing goes wrong, it throws the whole thing out. I mean,
it does. So that'll be my job today, putting out spot fires everywhere. And I don't know what it is about breakfast, but cooking eggs for people for breakfast has got to be one of the hardest things. Mm. Everyone likes it their own particular way.
Well, give them a fry pan and say, come out in the kitchen here.
Yeah, if they really knew what went on behind the scenes, but that's right. We're lucky. We've got a lot of local people where we are. We're very happy. We've been in our cafe for 15 years. So,
well, Brad,
I didn't have any grey hairs then, so now I've got a few.
Good to know you're listening, Brad, and good luck today. You'll need it.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for that.
Okay, mate. See you later. Cheers. Bye. Bye. Hello.
Yes, hello.
G'day. Yeah,
hello, Chris speaking.
Hi, Chris.
Yep. Yes, Chris Head here, your cycling correspondent from Flying Fish Point, just near Cairns, or Innisfail in North Queensland. But I'm currently in the Netherlands, and just a few days ago, my wife and I attended an 80th commemoration ceremony for 7 airmen who died in a Halifax bomber crash from World War II.
Yeah.
So they were having a commemoration ceremony, and I said, let's go to the Netherlands and be there for this special day. And so we went to the little town of Jelsum in Friesland.
Wow.
And and the people there, this little village, two little villages, Cornyum and Jelsum, did a commemoration ceremony
around the 7 Commonwealth war graves. The Australian ambassador for the Netherlands of the Kingdom of the Netherlands was there, Dr. Greg French, and the ambassador for the UK was there, the deputy ambassador, and a couple of French relatives of one of the airmen who died as well. It really was amazing and quite humbling to see these 7 graves in a tiny little village in the corner of the church and hear the story, how the people care for those graves and they're also looking out for other missing airmen.
And this has been happening for since the war?
That's correct, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's
about right. That? So, Chris, did you take your bike with you?
Coincidentally, yes, Mac, I did. We have a pull apart tandem.
All right. And Holland would be good for Holland would be good for riding a bike, wouldn't it? Because it's sort of flat, mostly.
It is mostly flat, but the bad news for us is it always seems to be a headwind, Macca. It's just unbelievable. So you know, my mother did say the Netherlands is flat, but just watch out for the wind.
Yeah.
Well, she was right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, nice to talk to you in the Netherlands, and the weather's okay over there?
It's always cold and windy here. We're from North Queensland. We start putting our jumpers on at 24 degrees Celsius, and so outside at the moment it's 13 degrees, but you drop that down 2 degrees for the wind chill. So we've had really good weather. We've had blue skies so far, fingers crossed. And we're cycling from Amsterdam to Copenhagen, just as a little side point.
Yeah, what an adventure, Chris. What an adventure. You've been there before to Holland, Netherlands?
We did a cruise a few years ago and briefly stopped in Amsterdam, but this time we managed to ride the tandem around Amsterdam.
You bike riders, you get everywhere, don't you? Good on you. Nice to talk to you, Chris.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Macca.
Good on you, mate. Bye. Annette's in Melbourne. Morning, Annette.
Good morning, Macca.
How's things? What are you up to in Melbourne?
Well, I'm gathered here with thousands and thousands of people ready to run the half marathon for the Mother's Day Classic.
Right around
raising money, raising money and awareness for breast cancer and ovarian cancer.
That's all around Australia, isn't it? The
yes,
Mother's Day
is.
Run, yeah. Are you a runner or have you just decided to do this?
No, I am a runner. However, I'm doing it for a girlfriend that passed away in February. She had breast cancer many years ago, was in remission, and then it all came back and she didn't even make 50, Macca. Her name was Marty.
So, Annette, there's a big crowd there. You'll be cool in Melbourne this morning, I suppose.
Yeah, look, it is cool, Macca, as the city wakes up. However, there's no breeze. It's very calm here. So it's quite pleasant, about 14 or 12 degrees, I reckon.
Better to run in the cool than the hot, Annette, I reckon.
Yes, 100%, Macca. Couldn't agree more.
You've been running. You're a runner. I assume, I'd say there'd be people who run in this half marathon who do it for a dare. And at the end of the day, they'll be recuperating for a couple of days or 3 or 4 days because they'll have stretched all their muscles.
Yes, I'm sure there's a lot more faster runners than me, but I started running long distances about 2013, doing Run for the Kids over the Balti Bridge in Melbourne, and I haven't stopped.
And it's good for you, you reckon? You're a changed person since you've been doing that, or?
100%. My fitness as well as in the mind, Macca. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, it's good to get out. And, you know, I was just talking to my little friend here about getting up early in the morning. I wouldn't like to do it every morning, but it's nice to get up in the dark and, you know, and especially in winter because it's cold and you just feel, it's nice to feel the change of temperature and the change of seasons, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, Macca.
All right.
I'd also like to say I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. Do you know where Wamagma is in New South Wales?
Yes, I do. I've heard. No, I don't know where it is, but I've heard. I've said the name many times. I've had a call or two from Wamagana.
Wamagma, yes.
Wamagma.
That's just south of Holbrook. Many people know Holbrook on the Hume Highway.
Yes, that's where the submarine is.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
We've got the submarine with no water, the pub with no beer, and the train tracks with no train.
Well,
that's where I'm originally from.
Oh, right.
And my dad would listen to you All the time, every Sunday morning.
And you're in, you live in Melbourne now, Annette?
Yes, yes.
Well, good luck with the run. You'll be fine, and it's great that people get out and support things like this. So there should be more of it, because I think it's very good for the psyche of the whole nation. And I reckon we need it. I reckon we need more of this sort of stuff and less of the sniping and things like that. If people got together, it'd be a much better world.
Couldn't agree more, Macca. You have a great day, and happy Mother's Day to all those mums out there.
Good on you.
Cheers.
See you. Bye.
Bye.
G'day, this is Macca.
Hi, it's Linda from Grange.
Grange in South Australia, Linda.
In Adelaide, yes.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
That's good. What are you doing?
I'm running up Mount Lofty.
Really? I can hear you're out of breath.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, sort of.
I thought I was more fit than that.
No. So what's... Okay. Tell me the story.
Oh, so I do it most mornings before I go to work. And so I try and do it Sundays as well. So all my family's sleeping in.
Yeah.
And for Mother's Day today, I've got kids who work part-time in hospitality. So no Mother's Day for me.
No.
But that's okay. That's fine because I love the house to myself. So my husband plays golf. So I'm just going to read a book. It's like an awesome day.
How long does your run up Mount Lofty take you, Linda?
I try and do under 40.
What, 40 minutes?
My personal best has been 38, but that was a while ago. So, it's good because it's nature. I see koalas, I see kangaroos, the occasional snake. So, it's good.
Yeah, well, it sounds good. It's good for you, good for the mind, I think, to get out there and do things.
Oh, yeah. No, I prefer being outside than in a gym, so...
Yeah, well, yeah. I think the same thing too. I don't know, there's a preponderance, a plethora now of gyms everywhere. You go past places, shopping centres, every little suburb's got a gym. It just seems to me like, I don't know, you're much probably better off working, doing something, you know, digging holes or planting your garden or whatever, I don't know. I think it's a better, but a lot of people in gyms, I suspect, are training for serious training for football or for running ultra marathons and things, I think.
Yeah, because the equipment's all there, so, you know, they're training for specific stuff.
And it's cool in Adelaide this morning?
Oh, this morning's awesome, the weather. So no wind, no rain. So, it's perfect Mother's Day.
Well, there's Mother's Day runs all over the place in Australia this morning. So you're sort of...
Too many people, though.
Yeah.
I didn't do fun runs and stuff. It's just like too many people. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Linda, it's, nice to talk to you. I never do anything as dramatic as that. I push a lawnmower sometimes and maybe dig a hole or whatever, but, whatever.
Yeah, I listen to you every Sunday when I do it, so I'm going to call one day, and I finally did, so,
What do you read, when you say you're reading, what do you read? Do you read books or you read just the paper and stuff?
Oh, no, I'm into books. So I'm into AI at the moment.
Oh, tell me. You're trying to work out what it is and what it means for us.
Yeah, I'm a software engineer.
Oh, I see.
So my job is kind of in that area. So I'm very interested in it.
So
I get the psychological stuff as well. And, it's a very interesting field.
I know. Did you hear... I spoke to Jerry Harvey the other day. When I say the other day, it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I was going to talk to him about, I forget what I was going to talk to him about. I think about retail and how things were going just generally. And we started talking about AI because he said, oh, look, just before you rang, he said, I had a call 10 minutes ago. He said, I won't tell you what it's about, but he said it was very disturbing for my business. He said, no, I hadn't thought about this before, so he said, now that's something that I've got to think about. And he said his management team now are going to have to go probably to Silicon Valley once every, or
where NVIDIA and those sort of people, once every like 4 months, because things change so much, every parameter of what you're doing, whatever business you're in, whatever you do in science or whatever, is changing all the time. People who don't know much about it, like me, Linda, just you can't worry about it, really. You're just better off running up Mount Lofty or going to mow the lawns, because you can't keep up with it, really.
Yeah. Well, it's a field that I'm interested in, so, you know, it's not really work when I say I read it. But, yeah, no, so it's fascinating, all the changes. And, like, the Terminator movie with those robots and with the killer robots, and I think, yeah, we're a long way off from that.
Well,
but, yeah. Well, not in my lifetime.
Let's hope so. I mean, it's very scary to think about it. And when they start talking about, you know, living on Mars and things like that, I mean, it's cold and there's no oxygen, and it takes about, you know, 12 months to get there, and then you got to wait there 6 months, and then you take another 12 months to get back. So it's ridiculous to me. I mean, but anyway.
Yeah. And our technology will get there, though.
Yeah, I suppose.
So, yeah, the 12 months will be reduced, and, you know, we'll build some super engine. Well, that's the hope.
But I don't want
to. I'm a Star Trekkie, so, you know, I have all these dreams that one day we'll get to Mars really quickly.
Well, yeah, all right. Linda, great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. All right, have a good Sunday.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye.
G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, hi, Macca. This is Ross.
Hi, Ross.
Calling from New Zealand, the Bay of Islands.
That's the North Island up the top, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. The Bay of Islands is a very beautiful part of the world.
Well, tell us, what are you doing there, Ross? You live there, you're visiting, what's going on?
Yeah, we live here. We moved here from Sydney just on 5 years ago. My partner and I, she's a Kiwi, she's an Auckland girl, and we decided we would move over here. We knew the Bay of Islands before we came. We bought a house a couple of years, actually, before we came here, and we were going to move over here when we retired. We both retired. I'm an ex-school teacher, and she's an office manager, but that thing called COVID came along and put a hold on our move to here, but we eventually got here.
So you listen to us on what, on an app or something, do you?
Yeah, through the net, yep. Of a Sunday morning, listen to your show.
And what's that, just to keep in touch with Oz because you miss us?
Yeah, in fact, I just came back. I spent 3 weeks over there week before last.
Mm-hmm.
I came over there. I did I'm an ex-sailor sort of thing. I came over and did a week's regatta up at Port Stephens. And then caught up with my family at different places.
Yeah, somebody rang me about that regatta at Port Stephens, I think. But anyway, you travel with your sailing. A lot of people do that. I bumped into a whole lot of people doing 18-footers in Sydney Harbour a couple of years ago, and they were from all over the world.
Yeah. No, I don't sail as much now. I used to do a lot of racing when I was in Sydney, yacht racing, and, you know, we've done Sydney to Hobart and East Coast races and all that sort of thing. But now over here in the Bay, I help out at the local sailing club. I do some youth coaching there and generally just enjoy the Bay itself. It's a beautiful place.
What's it like in New Zealand? I mean, you've been to Australia just recently. Things are very dear here. Inflation's, I think, out of control in Australia. And what's it like in New Zealand?
It's the same here. You know, the cost of living is quite high. And unemployment's very high. They're going through a transition period where, you know, the last government during COVID did all they could, and then a new government's taken over and they've cut and slashed and whatnot. My biggest worry for New Zealand is the brain drain, the fact that so many people are leaving to go and work in other places because of wages are a lot higher.
It's like a country town in Australia. That's the same thing that happens in country towns.
Yep, exactly. That's what's happening here. I worry, you know, another 10 years' time or so that, you know, the brain drain is going to cost you know, the migration will have to be very selective on bringing people in to cover jobs that people may have been trained to do, you know, just this time.
One of the things in Australia that people say to me, that they can't get people, Australians, to do all the jobs that are here, you know, just, I don't know what, you know, you go into a cafe or something and there's some kids there, but they're usually backpackers, or they're here for 6 months or 12 months and whatever, they're working in a pizza place, or they're working in a, you know, because they say Australian kids won't, kids that are born here and stuff won't do those jobs. I don't know if that's the story in New Zealand.
Yeah, to a point it's like that, yes. We live here in Paihia. It's a tourist town, and you know, there's a lot of backpackers come through, and they do work in the restaurants and cafes and so forth. You know, it's a turnover workforce, but yeah, there is a feeling that there is a generation of lazy people that won't, you know, they'll take handouts from the government and all that sort of thing, but won't go and work for it.
And there's not technological jobs in New Zealand that'll attract graduates and all sorts of people who are interested in working in media or working in technology to keep them there, so they go overseas, more money, more, you know, more allure, I suppose.
Yep. Particularly to Australia, the wage difference between here and Australia is quite significant. But the one on the other side of the coin is that because the exchange rate is quite good to come Australia to come to here, our tourist industry, there's a lot of Australians travelling around here at the moment.
Mm. Oh, well, there's good and bad and everything, I suppose, Ross. All right. Nice to talk to you, Ross, this morning. Yeah. And it's nice to know you're listening in New Zealand. We did a program in New Zealand about, 15 years ago, somewhere at the Anzac Day, it was, at the War Memorial Museum there in Auckland somewhere. And that was a good time. And I'd like to go back to New Zealand and do a program. I think it's interesting because we've got a lot in common with New Zealand, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I think you're right there. And the bay up here, we categorise the bay like a mini Whitsundays. If you know the Whitsunday Passage up in Queensland, the Bay of Islands is a mini Whitsunday Passage. Wonderful, beautiful.
All right, well, nice to talk to you. Good on you.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for your call, Ross.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
It's food for thought, isn't it? When you talk to people from other places, and he's an Oz. G'day, this is Macca.
G'day, Macca. It's Aaron here. How are you going?
Aaron.
Yeah, Aaron, bringing you from a payphone at the front of a mine site in outback South Australia.
Well, they're free now, mate, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's a free phone now, it's not a payphone.
Well, we call it a public phone now, yeah. So Aaron, good, what do you do? You're at Olympic Dam.
Yep, Olympic Dam.
And what's happening, mate? What do you do?
Just general mining, machine operator up here. So 7 on, 7 off, lifestyle roster.
How long have you been doing that? Tell us about working at Olympic Dam and what it's like and the people who work there.
Oh, the people here are amazing. Like, it is great. This is one of the best sites I've ever been on. Give a shout out to Gavin. He's out there on the long reach digger at the moment. I love working in the mines because you meet a lot of people from all over Australia. And, it's really good. Really good mine here. They really look after us.
And where do you come from? Where's home for you, Aaron? Do you fly in, fly out, or you?
Yeah, I'm down at Victor Harbour, God country. Love it down there.
Well, that's good. And so you've been working there for how long?
I've been at this site for just over 2 years now, but I've been doing mining for, over 20 years.
And that's because why? Because it pays well?
It's more the lifestyle. The pay is good, but it's the lifestyle. It's the week off that you get. So, if you got anything planned, you just take a block off, take a week off, and then all of a sudden you've got 3 weeks off in a row. So, works out good for when you want to go on holiday.
And what's it like working at a uranium mine, mate?
Uranium is just a byproduct. We're mainly after copper.
Uh-huh.
And gold, silver, uranium, it's all the byproducts.
And copper's... Well, it's almost like gold now. It's not, but, it's very, very expensive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's what we want.
Yeah, and that's
I just want to give a give a shout out to all the mums out there for Mother's Day. The mums are past, present, and pregnant.
Past, present, and pregnant. If you got, are you married? You got kids?
Yeah, I got a couple, got three kids. Yep, got me wife at home. Yeah,
And she, you just go home what, every 2 weeks or something? Is it what?
Every 7 days, every week.
Every seven.
Fly in on a Monday, fly out the next Monday.
It's like a bloke I met on board a ship, and he said, "Yeah," he said, he was doing 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. I think it was something ridiculous, maybe three weeks on a ship." And he said, "Yeah, I'll go home, fix things up, and make sure the kids, you know." And of course, his wife's home there for 3 weeks doing all the work. But he made out that, I'll go home go home every 3 weeks and fix things up, and then, you know. And I said, "Yeah." It's the girls who do the work, Aaron, I reckon.
They do, yeah. It's tough mentally when you're working away from the family.
Mm.
But for them, they've got to, you've got to have a strong connection, a strong family at home to be able to hold the fort while you're gone and do the things you do. But, you get home and you've got a massive list of jobs you got to do. That's all right. Well, keep you busy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you feel like you're needed there, Aaron. If you came home and there was nothing to do, you'd think, well, I'm superfluous to requirements. So, you need a list.
Speaking of lists, I'm turning 39 on Tuesday.
Mm.
I've started this thing. It's a bit of a trend lately where you do 40 things before you're 40. It's 40 things you've never done in your life.
And what, this is a general thing or it's just your little shtick?
Just anything, yeah. Lots of people do it. You just sort of make the list yourself, and I've already ticked one of them off, which was just go to a rodeo.
Right. Where was that at?
That was down at Murray Bridge. It was the first one they had in 13 years. It's really good.
Yeah, they're fun, yeah. So, and you've done one. Is that what you're saying? You've done one?
Yeah, I only ticked off one so far, but yeah.
So you've got 38.
Bungee jumping. Bungee jumping's the next one, but you've got to go to Cairns. It's the only place in Australia where you can bungee jump.
Right. So, and you want to do this before you're 40, so you've got a year to do it. Is that right?
Got a year to do it. Yep. Got a year to stick it off.
Well, I suppose if you pick simple things like mow the lawn, they're easy to do. But if you want to do things like climb Mount Everest and stuff like that, which I suppose is on some people's list of things to do, you're going to have your work cut out for you, mate.
Oh, you definitely will. You definitely will.
Well, it's a good idea. It's a good idea, but you can do some thoughtful things, not just some selfish things about what I want to do, but things you can do for everybody too. You could put a few of those in your list. Back. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be good. And what's it like at Olympic Dam this morning in the phone box, mate?
6.5 degrees, so it's pretty chilly, but there's not a breath of wind. It's quite nice. I love the desert. Absolutely love it. The red dirt gets in your blood and you just can't get it out.
Exactly. Do you want a T-shirt? We'll send you a T-shirt.
Yeah, 100%. I'll love a T-shirt.
I'll leave you on hold we can get an address and we'll send you a T-shirt. The only thing is that we've only got medium ones left. So are you huge or...?
No, I'll squeeze into a medium. Might make me go to the gym a bit more.
You'll have to, mate, because they're large. Yeah, all the other ones are gone. Even the small ones are gone.
I can chuck it on me list, my 40 before 40 list, to fit into a medium shirt, eh?
All right. Good on you, mate.
Thanks, Macca.
Thanks, Aaron. Bye. This is the All Over News. This is the All Over News, and do you ever wonder what's under the tarps of the big trucks that fly around the highways and byways of Australia? I always do. I think, I wonder what they're carrying. And you may have seen my next guest on the road somewhere between Brisbane and Western Australia in the last week or two. He's got an unusual load. It's not under a tarp or anything like that. His name is Eric Duren, and you'll love this, and he's on the line. Good morning, Eric.
Okay, how are you, mate?
Tell Australia what you got and what you're carrying, mate.
I've got 2 7-metre black Carnaby cockies on the back of my trailers. Fiberglass they're made from.
So tell us the story of these Carnaby cockatoos.
Yep, it's been a while in the making. The guys in Moore have had a bit of trouble trying to get it up and off the ground and going. I think it's been 5 years to this stage. So they're finally made and they're finally on their way home. So
these sculptures were made in Brisbane.
Yep,
and
definitely.
Where are you from, Eric? What's your part in all this?
Yep, I'm from Moora in WA, where they're going, and I got pretty well conned into carting them.
Seems like a noble cause. They're a lovely bird. They're an endangered species, and so you've been over to Brisbane, you've picked them up, yep. And now you're on your way back to Moora, is that right?
Yep, that's correct. And I'm currently in Port Augusta, going to fuel up here and keep going.
So these are huge, big black Carnaby's cockatoos. So what do people say? I bet everyone wants to stop and talk to you.
They do. They want to stop and have a look. I had to stop in Peterborough because some of the woodwork's starting to fall apart on the back, and I had to go to the hardware and pull out all this drill and a saw and a few tech screws and put it all back together. Yeah.
So they're in crates, are they?
No, they're actually on a stand. They're laying on a stand so we can transport them. Yeah, everybody's looking at them, that's for sure. Yep.
You're a truck driver, Eric?
Yes, I am. Yeah, trying to retire, Mecca.
But not having much luck?
No, no. Not when jobs keep coming up like this. A mate of mine, Alan, he's involved in this as well. He goes, what if I come with you and we both go over to Brisbane? And I go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that. Because I hadn't actually said, yes, I'll cart these at that stage. And then a couple of days he rings me back and he goes, I'm not coming with you. And I go, why? What's wrong, Alan? And he goes, it's too far. Thanks, Alan. Now I've got to do it all by myself. So.
What's it been like carting? How long's it taken you to get over there with these? I suppose you've got to take it. You got a low loader or something, have you?
Yeah, I've got a drop deck on the back, but that's got other freight on that. And these are just on a normal flat top. Yeah, sitting on a cradle sort of thing, and they tie down nicely so they don't move around.
When will you get tomorrow, do you reckon?
Tuesday, I should be home, because they want me to stop in Ravensthorpe as well, so they can have a look at it.
Everybody should see it. Been an interesting trip for you, obviously.
Absolutely. It's been a good trip, yeah. But I think Queensland needs to do a bit to their roads, because that was the roughest. Now I'm back in South Australia, it's pretty easy going.
Good to talk to you, Eric.
Macca, thanks heaps, mate.
I think I've told you before that in the day of the letter, which is no longer, we used to get lots and lots of letters about all sorts of things, but the preponderance was about Anzac Day. And I've got files and files of Anzac Day letters. And I came across this the other day because it's, as my teacher would say, it's right on the course. It was 30 years ago from a bloke called Nev Rackerman. He might have been related to Carl, you know, the great Australian fast bowler. Nev says to me, very briefly, this is the story I'd like to tell you. You'll probably recall the Australian Bicentennial Authority's historical records search, the major heritage project for 1988. Seems like 1,000 years ago, he says. I was one of 30 field officers Australia-wide associated with the search, and your program gave the project much appreciated coverage. One collection of records I recorded were those owned by a Kathleen Sargent. One item was an unpublished manuscript written by her husband, Jack. This is an account of a 1931 voyage he made in a 12-foot wooden boat from the New South Wales-Queensland border to Murray Bridge in South Australia. Just consult your maps on that one. The New South Wales-Queensland border to Murray Bridge in South Australia. With the manuscript was a collection of photographs taken during the voyage. As I've had experience, says Nev, in writing, I recognise this material as a basis for a good story. After I concluded my commitment with historical record search, I decided to write Jack Sargent's biography. To the best of my research, Jack's voyage in the Lone Star, that's his rowing boat, down the Darling-Murray River system, is the longest small open boat voyage in Australia's history, and as such has remained virtually unknown for now 90 years. During the late 60s or 70s, I can't recall which, two brothers, who were associated with a well-known adventure-stroke-travel TV program, and a companion, travelled less than half the distance covered by Jack and claimed it as a first and record distance. That has to be the Leyland brothers, doesn't it? And interestingly, the last surviving Leyland brother, Mal Leyland, with his daughter, I think with his daughter and others, are recreating some of the tracks and treks that the Leyland brothers did all those years ago at the moment. That voyage by the Leylands was accomplished in company in an aluminium boat with an outboard motor. Jack did his voyage alone and with oars. I consider the photographs of historical value, some more so than others, as they depict scenes long gone and hidden forever by the waters of various irrigation schemes. The scenes described by Jack are too numerous to mention here, but they include references to towns and hamlets of all that time ago, prickly pear infestations, life on the river, both animal and human, and the plight of those living in dolmens, that's dolmens, camps along the banks of rivers during the Great Depression. As if that was not enough to make a good story, I received a bonus. This was access to Jack's war diary. Jack spent 12 months in Portuguese Timor during World War II in 1942. He arrived as a private or lance corporal and returned a lieutenant. Jack was part of Sparrow Force, sent to Timor, which made a heroic attempt to halt a Japanese invasion of the island. The Japs arrived in overwhelming numbers. A few hundred Australian troops managed to escape into the mountainside. These men had no means of contacting Darwin Army headquarters by radio, or in those days, as it was known, the wireless. Army headquarters gave the men up for dead, or at least, at best, captured. The Australians had a fairly good supply of weapons and ammunition, but seriously lacked food, clothing, boots, money, medicine, and most other equipment and stores necessary to troops on active duty. Nevertheless, ignoring a call by the enemy to surrender, the Australians committed themselves to a guerrilla war against Japanese forces. Consequently, they were declared outlaws by the Japanese High Command and pre-sentenced to execution on capture. Jack Sargent was one of the small group of signallers given the, what was generally thought, impossible task of contacting Darwin by wireless. At great personal risk, because Japanese patrols kept the Australians continually on the move, and through sheer wireless genius, a wireless set was eventually built. This set has been described as a conglomeration of wire, tin and useless bits and pieces of old destroyed wireless and telegraph sets filling a whole room. Power was supplied by four Timorese turning a bicycle wheel connected to an old car generator. And after 56 days, contact was regained with Darwin. It can be imagined how this news was received. Several hundred Australian troops returning from the dead, as it were. At first, fearing a Japanese trick, very personal questions were asked of the operator at the Timor end. This operator was Jack Sargent. Some of the questions related to his wife, Kathleen. The outcome of this contact was the supplying of the troops in Portuguese Timor and a decision to carry on the guerrilla war. During the 12-month period of this fighting, it is estimated that 4,000 Japanese were killed at a cost of 40 Australians. More importantly, when Japanese troops were urgently required in New Guinea, at least 10,000 crack Japanese troops were tied up in Portuguese Timor in an effort to capture a handful of Australians. The hybrid wireless transmission set known as Winnie the War Winner is now housed in the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. Had not Jack Sargent and the other members of the team, as it was a team effort, managed to construct this set, there is no doubt at all that eventually all the survivors of Sparrow Force would have been captured and executed. And without the set, the successful Portuguese Timor campaign would have not been possible. Although I was not fortunate enough to meet Jack Sargent, he has been described by his wife, Kathleen, as a man who did not blow his own trumpet. His reaction to the claim made by the Leyland brothers during their TV program was, "Well, if they want to claim a record, that's okay with me. I know what I did, and that's all that matters." Of his association with Winnie the War Winner, he was more reticent. His reaction to questions about this episode was, he was only doing what he's paid to do. Going through this manuscript for 2 years now feels like I've been associated with Jack for a long time. To me, he was, to use a hackneyed but apt expression, one of many unsung Australian heroes. And Nev Rackerman concluded this letter, which he sent to me in the 90s, by saying, "Ian, I've just completed the first draft of Jack's biography, which I've entitled Tributaries of Life." Now, I don't know whether Nev got that published or whatever, but I think it's a most interesting and wonderful Australian story. Would that we could all travel down the Darling and the Murray in an open wooden boat with oars. G'day, this is Macca.
Yeah, Macca, it's Lenny from Dartmouth here. Last time I rang you, I told you that the dam was overflowing.
Oh, right, I remember. Yeah, we heard it. You could hear it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's happened this morning? We're making it snow in Bourke.
Tell me more. That'll be good.
Well, I'm driving a pilot vehicle behind two slashers, and they're about probably 600 or 700 metres ahead of me. And all the cotton's coming out of the grass onto the highway, and it looks as though it's snowing.
What a picture. What a picture. You should take a photo or a video. Send it to me. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I could do that for you, mate. Yeah, but, yeah, it's a beautiful day out here. And I just heard that song of Drifting Down the Darling.
Yeah, nice song. Nice song.
Yeah, but I thought I'd ring and let you know, Macca, this is what we're doing of a Sunday.
Lenny, good on you. Lenny, it's a long way from Dartmouth.
Yes, it is, but, yeah, mate, the other crew come from Albury and we couldn't get workers, so they absconded the old 76-year-old from Dartmouth and he's helping out.
You couldn't get workers?
No, he has trouble getting workers to drive the pilot vehicle.
Uh-huh. So then that's what you've done for your living, Lenny, mostly?
No, I'm just helping him out to get him over a bind because, yeah, mate, you want to see the amount of critters that had passed on along the side of the road. Like, we done 14K the other day, and there was 85, and yesterday we done 22K, and there was 291 carcasses in 22K.
Of all sorts of things.
Yeah, all sorts of things, from cows to emus to goats to cattle, yeah, foxes, wild cats, everything.
And is this because the season's good out there, or has it been dry out there?
No, it's dry out here, mate. Yeah, some places there's not a blade of grass. But for some reason, along the side of the road, there's a grass out here that's very thick, very hard to cut. The boys are complaining on the mowers every day, and it's very hard to cut, and it's just unreal. Like, you know, it's probably 2 to 3 foot high.
Yeah, and probably tough stuff to cut too.
Very, very tough. Just hang on, I've got to do this. Yeah, a white one coming and a ute behind it. That lets them know that they've got traffic coming behind them, Magga.
Yeah, good on you, Lenny. Yeah.
All right, mate, thanks for the call.
You called us.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You talk to me.
It's live radio. Good on you, Lenny.
Thanks, pal. Bye.
See ya. G'day, this is Macca.
G'day, Macca.
G'day.
Hello, Macca.
Yep.
Yeah, it's Tanya Kernighan calling. How you doing?
Oh, long time no speak, Tanya. Where are you? What are you doing?
Well, I'm actually in Mount Isa at the moment, and it was interesting listening to Bim talk to you just previously.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Bush Telegraph when you're on the radio, because last year I took part in a part of the Great Australian Cattle Drive, the charity drive, and rode a horse for a few hours before a show, and it was just fantastic following 1,500 head of cattle and all the stories and yarns and wonderful people that I met over those couple of days. It was just terrific. So good luck to Bim and all the crew for the next successful event.
Did you sleep overnight with the cattle? No.
I didn't sleep with the cattle, no. I've slept with a lot of – no, I shouldn't say that. I'm not going to say that.
No, you're not going to say that. Why I asked you, because if you've ever slept on a cattle drive and the eerie sound of – 1,000 sleeping cattle at night, like in the middle of the night when, and there's just a different sound, you know. You can hear them. They're asleep on their feet, sort of, and they're just still and they're in the thing. And yeah, anyway, I just thought I'd say that. I'll shut up now. What are you doing? Why are you in the Isa, Tanya?
Oh, you know, I was here. I've been out here for a few days, and on Friday night I emceed the Underground Hospital and Museum Gala Night. It was a 1940s themed night called Swing on a Star, and Macca, you would have absolutely loved it.
Mm-hmm.
The
would
girls
you like
from...
to swing on a star?
Yeah.
Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off in... Did they sing that?
Yeah, or are you better off where you are? Or would you rather be
a pig or a donkey or whatever, yep.
Yes, we had the Pacific Bells come from Sydney, and they're like an Andrew Sisters tribute show, and it was just fantastic. In the mood, boogie woogie boogle boy. I was having such a great time, and I was sitting at my table during their performances and my feet were dancing underneath the table, and I wished so much that someone would come and ask me to have a dance.
Really? Were they all dancing, were they?
Oh, a few people got up and danced, and I thought, oh, God, where's a good-looking fellow when you need one?
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be good-looking as long as he can dance.
Well, that's right.
That's the deal.
The main thing. Yeah. But, so I came out here, and I didn't realise, Macca, the significance of the Underground Hospital and Museum and just how fantastic it is, and the reason why it was built back in when Darwin was being bombed and Catherine. And I didn't realise that... that the hospital actually never did get used. It was just sort of left to rack and ruin until a group of volunteers and council and supporters got together and turned it into a museum. And it's just a wonderful place to visit. And I encourage anybody who's coming out here to go and see it. It's really terrific.
And sounds like a good place to have a party too.
Was
that where it was held? Was it the ball was, in the...
Yes.
In the hospital, yeah, it sounds like a good place. It's always nice to have It got a good dance floor. It was a wooden dance floor, was it?
Well, it was actually the hospital ground. So it was, it was a dirt area, but they turned it into a wonderful evening with lighting and seating and dance floor, and the backdrop was this beautiful side of a hill with all lit up with lights, and it looked truly spectacular. So there was a great turn up for that, and then of course last night they had the big Queensland Music Trails crescendo or finale here at the Mount Isa rodeo grounds at Buchanan Park, and they had artists from all over the place finishing off that show, because they'd been travelling out through Quilpie and Charleville and Longreach and all over the place encouraging Australian music and getting people to sort of follow that trail and get the caravanners and tourists out here, which was a great success also.
Yeah, people love that, I know not everybody, but that music from the 40s and 50s, it's just great. And as you say, when you hear In the Mood and stuff like that, but you've got to be able to, when you see old movies and people dancing, they could really dance. They could really dance. I couldn't dance to save me legs, if you know what I mean. But it's something about that sort of music when it just bounces and it's just makes your feet move. As you said, your feet were tapping under the table. It's great music.
And it's happy music too. And that's the thing about music, and you know very well when you get out there and perform, when you play your songs and you're entertaining the people, it doesn't matter if you're a brickie or a professor or anybody else in between. When the music starts, everybody is on equal ground and everybody loves it and the joy that it brings. And
we need more music, Tanya. We need more music.
And live music, because that's one thing AI cannot do. Those girls that got up and sang on Friday night, the Pacific Bells, it would have looked pretty darn stupid being avatars. So,
robots.
On them. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so no, that's one thing they can't take away from us yet.
Take that away from me. That's so great. So I know all those songs because I grew up when I was a kid, they were playing all those songs. You probably know them too. Tanya,
I love them all, just like you. Yes,
great to talk to you, Tanya. We'll have to catch up sometime. We'll bump into you on the road of song somewhere, hopefully.
Yes, that'd be wonderful, Macca. And I've got to say, the countryside. I know that a lot of the country is in drought, but the countryside out here around Mount Isa is absolutely spectacular, and the colours and the birds and the atmosphere. And I was only saying to Kel on the phone earlier that it's the people that make a place, and when you come to Mount Isa, there's such a strong sense of community here that you feel so very welcome. And I find that happens so often in these great Australian outback towns. And, I just love being out here. And I'm happy to call you anytime from wherever I might be, because if I can bring a bit of that community spirit to your show, then, we're all winners.
Exactly. That's well said. Community is what it's all about. And I think we've lost that a bit in Australia. But, people like you, we're working on it. And we're trying to do it here on Sunday morning too, where people talk from all over. Yeah. Good on you, Tanya. Great to talk to you, doll.
Good. I will meet again. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Yeah. Good on you.
Love you, Macca.
See you,
mate.
Where are you, Michael?
Yeah, Macca, I'm in Caldermead at the minute, mate, picking milk up.
Where's Caldermead for the rest of Australia?
Oh, halfway between, Langatha and Cranbourne.
So
in Victoria.
Yes, of course.
Not far from the island, actually, Phillip Island.
Mm-hmm.
And
you've got one of those shiny silver tankers.
Yeah, mate, yeah. I'm only in a single this morning. Normally I drive a 26, but, it's a good job.
Tell people what a 26 is, mate.
Oh, that's the big B-double, but, it holds 40,000 litres. You've got 20 in the front and 20 in the back.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so...
And where do you take that to?
We do a lot of deliveries in Melbourne, and we do a lot of transfers. We go Warrnambool, Allensford. Yeah, we do all sorts of... We do a lot of deliveries in Melbourne, like every day there's probably maybe 15 deliveries to town, and then we do farm pickup on the way home.
And you enjoy that, mate?
Yeah, I like it, mate. It's a good job.
When you get out to the farms and you meet people, don't you, out at the farms, you talk to the farmers?
Yeah, that's right, mate, yeah.
And they'll be pleased to see you.
Yeah, but what I rang up for, Macca, is I had a my brother-in-law passed away this week, and he had a last wish. Anyway, I was up the hospital with him. You know, he only had about 3 days to go, and the palliative nurse said to Terence and Tex, and one last wish, what would you like to do? And he said, all I want to do is, if you can get me in the car and take me around the farm one more time. Anyway, we're looking out the window, and there's a helipad there, and I said to the palliative care nurse, I said, would we be allowed to land the helicopter there, you know? And she said, look, I don't think so, but anyway, look, she said, I'll leave it with you, see what you can organise. Anyway, she said, you better make it sooner than later. So the next day, I rang my brother-in-law, and I remembered his future son-in-law has got his pilot licence, flies choppers out of Moorabbin. So anyway, we teed it up. We went and got a maxi cab, and we got him in a wheelchair and took him out to the farm and out to Tony's farm. They landed the chopper out there, and we all lifted him in the chopper, and he went out to his farm with his son. And, yeah, it was just, yeah, and he sort of went 3 days later, so it was pretty special, mate, you know?
I'll say, it's a lovely, story, Mike, yep.
Yeah, and I just thought, look, you know, I listen to you all the time. I've always loved, you know, because it's just all over Australia, and Terence was a, you know, there was five boys and two girls in the family, and he was the oldest. He was only 69, but, you know, he never whinged, he was amazing, actually, you know? He knew he was going, but, yeah, it was just, yeah. And it was just good that we took him over the farm for the last time with his son, and, yeah, it was great.
Lovely story, Michael. Good on you, mate. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, good on you, Macca. Thanks for listening, and, all the best. And
it's a pleasure.
And all the mums that are out there, yeah, have a good Mother's Day.
Thanks, Michael.
See you, Macca.
Linda's in Gilderton. Good morning, Linda.
Morning, Macca. From lovely Gilderton, where the sun's only just coming up.
Mm-hmm.
We're 90 kilometres north of Perth. I'm sitting out looking out the Moore River estuary. Beautiful place to be. Lovely community up here too.
There you go. And what do you do for Mother's Day, Linda? What's happening?
I'm actually going. The country club's putting on a Mother's Day, so we'll head up there today. It'll be good.
It's a big day, isn't it? Brad rang earlier this morning, and he's a chef, and he said he's got a restaurant. He said, "Well, it'll be bedlam today," because we like to take Mum for a meal or something like that, don't we? And there's always something on. Like you've got something on at the country club, and it's a jungle out there, mate. Everybody's heading to.
It's fantastic, fantastic. One day of the year, it's great. But what I rang to tell you about, which I'd like a lot of people to know about, is a proposal up here to make a new national park between the northern boundary of Perth at Two Rocks and this beautiful river. It's 12 kilometres of coastline and 10 kilometres inland to the Indian Ocean Drive, which goes north from Perth. And it's beautiful bushland that's full of chewits and banksias, and the Carnaby cockatoos live there. It links in with Yanchep National Park. And it's just a fantastic bit of bushland that we think needs protecting for the people of Perth, WA, Australia to come and...
That sounds like a good idea. The Carnabys are going to be at Mora. Did you hear the story yet? You probably haven't heard it.
I did. Yeah. Yes, I've contributed to the big Carnabys. They've been fundraising for years. It's been a lot of work to get those in. I can't wait to see them.
No, they're 7 or 8 metres high, ladies and gentlemen, if you've just woken up. And they were made in Brisbane, and they were on the back of a truck from Brisbane, the back over to Mora, and they'll be there Tuesday or Wednesday, I think, and they'll erect them in the park there. And great tourist attraction, great ecological attraction. They're wonderful things. I love it. We should look after our natives, you know, birds and animals and plants and stuff. It's what makes us different. It's what makes us different.
And this area is one of 34 biodiversity hotspots in the whole world. And so the bush we've got here is different from the east. The east's got wonderful bush, but we've got different stuff, and we need to protect what we've got left.
I'll come and have a look at it. Linda, nice to talk to you.
Okay, can I just tell you, Macca, we've got a film about it. It's at the Lunar on Leaderville on May the 21st at 6:30. If all the Perthites go and have a look at wilbinga.com, and it's a free showing, and we'd love to have lots of interest and lots of people there.
At Leaderville, what date?
Thursday, 21st of May.
All right. Okay.
So week after next. Wilbinga.com has got all the details.
Wilbinga.com. Good on you. Thanks, Linda.
Thanks, Macca.
Bye. Alan's in Melbourne. Is that right, Alan?
Good morning, Macca. Yes, it's East Melbourne.
And what's happening, mate?
Well, we've got a cool overcast day, and it's just about the perfect day for people to visit the Royal Exhibition Buildings in Melbourne, probably our most magnificent building. Yesterday marked the 125th anniversary of the first sitting of the Parliament of the Commonwealth of Australia.
Wow, in the Royal Exhibition, I've seen photos of that.
It's a magnificent photo, well, the painting that was done by Charles Nuttall, obviously off a photograph. 12,000 people attended on the 9th of May in 1901. Yesterday, perhaps 500-600 people attended, but there was terrific recognition of the fact that after all those years of fighting between the colonies, the question of tariff trading between New South Wales and Victoria, it was finally settled. The Commonwealth was established, but the Parliament was not able to sit until the 9th of May. And it was in the presence of the Duke of Cornwall and Wales. He and the Princess Mary were here, and that was recognised yesterday. He, of course, went on to become King George.
Interesting, isn't it? And as I said, it's a bit of an earthquake a day yesterday in Australia for that election in Farrow, even though it's just a small little by-election. In some ways, it's a seismic change in Australian politics in lots of ways. A lot of rethinking for all the other parties, I think, all of the other parties. So,
well, the politicians back in 1901, of course, they came from various backgrounds, very parochial interests initially, but they had been elected to the Commonwealth for that first parliamentary sitting. The building is extremely impressive and a great place to visit. Some people don't have mothers. Some mothers might like to go there this afternoon. You can see the carriage, the horse-drawn carriage that ferried the prince, or the duke rather, and Princess Mary to the exhibition buildings. There's also, as well as the great painting that I mentioned, there's also the wooden steps that were created. They had to be made for the Duke to step up onto the dais. Those wooden steps were then removed by the builder, taken to his used in his house in Ascot Vale, a suburb of Melbourne, and they've been retrieved from there and repositioned in the exhibition buildings. Just fascinating to
Lovely
see
stuff.
How the Parliament got together.
Yeah. Well, I'll make sure I go and have a look in the Royal Exhibition Building next time I'm in Melbourne, which shouldn't be too long. Alan, good on you. Cool in Melbourne this morning?
Yes, indeed. Cool and overcast, a little bit damp.
All right, mate. Great to talk to you. Thanks for alerting Australia to that.
Cheers, Macca.
See you, mate. Bye.
Bye.
G'day, this is Macca.
Morning, Macca. Kingy. From Geraldton.
Do I know you, Kingy?
Yes, you do. I've done a couple of things. I did a rail run over into Queensland there that time with some voluntary rail. I rang you when I was in the bus once as well. I wish I was in the bus now, actually.
So where are you? You're at Marble Bar with a road train, is it?
Yeah, road train of sodium hydroxide or caustic. Just come back from a mine site down at Nullagine.
And where do you go to now?
Back to Port Hedland, and then hopefully hook onto some more trailers and go home to Geraldton, hopefully.
Hopefully. And this is your gig mainly, Michael?
Yeah, we do. But all the stuff I do is like chemicals nowadays. We were doing a lot of salt for the oil and gas industry, but that's stopped at the moment. So chemicals, there's a few mines booming up around in the Pilbara here nowadays. So we've got one big job starting in another couple of weeks' time.
How would you describe things in the West there in the mining? All systems go. Is it really busy over there?
Look... It's a seasonal bit of a dropout now at the moment, but yes, there's projects starting iron ore. There's hundreds and hundreds of trucks up here carting iron ore from satellite mines into the ports and that sort of thing, plus the rail. And consequently, there's all the obviously the fuel trucks and everything else to service that. Port Hedland's a shocking town nowadays. It turns over the biggest dollars at the port. You can't even barely drive down the road at the back of the port. You know, they just don't spend any money on anything. It's just all scalped. I just come over the Nullagine Road, 112 k's. It took me 4 hours to do 112 k's.
Yeah, the roads are that bad, eh?
Yeah, look, the Marble Bar Road was done up. I've been here for 35 years, but the Marble Bar Road was all done up and everyone was satisfied with that. But now the trucks are that big and that many trucks on the road, won't be long that road. Should be a dirt road again too.
See, I would think most of us would think that most of the iron ore is on trains, but it's not. It's on trucks as well.
Honestly, Macca, it should be. There should have been a train line built from, you know, Port Hedland out to at least Telfer for all the stuff that's gone over there for the last 50-odd years. And these satellite mines, they could have another railway line. It's like that Central Queensland line they're talking about. It's just brain dead if it doesn't go in, you know. It's just stupid. We're going backwards. We're not going forward in this country, you know. Like, this transport, like, it's good for us, but our stuff isn't a big enough quantity to be bulk on trains. So, yeah, but anything that could be bulk on trains should be on trains. That's as simple as that, you know.
Exactly.
Or we need express freeways built all over the country as roadways to cater for it. So,
Michael, you're parked at Marble Bar. Give us a look out your window. What are you looking at?
I'm 9 k's out. I've just come in on the Telfer Road from Nullagine, so that doesn't come right into Marble Bar. But I'll give you a hint. After all my breakdowns and 2 flat tyres last night, I'm heading to Marble Bar to have breakfast. So if you want to wait till I get in there, I'll give you a ring.
Oh, I'll come with you. I'd love to come with you.
I just want to say good day to Cal Baxter too. I've had a bit to do with Cal with the old army trucks and that.
Michael, are you celebrating Mother's Day in any way, shape or form?
No, unfortunately, lost mum 8 years ago. Yeah, lost her 8 years ago. I'm the last standing member of our family because I lost mum and then dad and then me brother, so I'm it. Unfortunately.
Well, but, nice to talk to you this morning, Michael. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so good day to all the mums out there. They certainly deserve it.
Good on you, mate. Nice to talk to you.
Especially when they put up with little bastards like me in their lives.
So, see you, mate. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Macca.
Good on you, mate. G'day, this is Macca.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
It's Maxine. Yep. I just didn't know if it was me. I'm ringing from Guangzhou in China.
Guangzhou. Where's that? Not that I know. My Chinese geography is sadly lacking, Maxine, but Guangzhou. So is
mine. It's where the Terracotta Warriors, I think, are. It's about 2 hours out of Beijing, but we're only transiting from, we've just come from Europe, so we're only here for a couple of hours transiting in the airport.
And you decided to give me a ring from the airport?
Yeah. Well, we had my two brothers and myself and our spouses, we're all in our 60s, or a couple of 70 actually, have just ridden around the Somme battlefields for a week, and it was very sobering. Very interesting.
Tell me why it was sobering for you.
Oh, look, you know, I mean, we went to Villers-Bretonneux, which is, of course, the village that has been restored, and the school was built by Victorian Education through those kids. So everywhere it's got Never Forget Australia, and they treat you like royalty to go there. And they've received so many donations back of medals and uniforms and everything. It's just, I think the biggest one that we were, was Tyne Cot, which is up on Flanders Fields, 12,000 graves there.
You see all the graves. You see all the graves. That's the thing that I suspect hits you in the face when you see all those graves there.
Well, yeah, there's 12,000, but 8,300 of them aren't identified yet. But it's amazing. And look, the Commonwealth war graves, they do an amazing job. They are so beautifully kept. There are flowers. It's gorgeous. It's one German cemetery, which was very different at Fricourt. Very austere, just black crosses, four in each. And that was just so obvious compared to the Commonwealth ones, which were just so beautifully kept with, as I said, flowers and poppies and whatever. But because we were cycling through the whole region, you know, there were poppies along, wild poppies growing along the side of the road and wildflowers. It was just spectacularly beautiful.
Maxine, go on.
No, I was going to say the other thing I've got to say is I know the cost of living in Australia is outrageous and we're really struggling, but it's nothing to Europe. We were paying over $4 for a litre of petrol. A Coke was like $10. It is, you know, in Budapest, prior to our ride, we'd come down on a boat cruise from Amsterdam to Budapest. They're earning about $1,200 a month as an average income and their rent is $800 a month. They haven't got a hope of buying a place. They're all renting, but the cost of living over here is just mind-blowing. Australia doesn't know.
Australia does. I think Sydney's probably the dearest place in the world. You know, you have to see it to believe it.
In terms of real estate, yeah.
You get your car repaired and the prices that have just gone through the roof. It's
punnet of strawberries was $12 here.
Yeah, well,
to buy punnet of strawberries. But look, the whole world's suffering, and we know why. But that's okay. But look, the Somme was just. There were lots of. In fact, there was a group of kids from Queensland who were just there, and I think the number of groups of kids we saw. There were kids from England, kids from France, but there were a couple of groups from Australia. I think the reality of it is just so different when they're sitting in a classroom reading about it.
Yeah, a lot of them do that trip, which is really good. As I say, anything you can do to get kids out of the classroom, I reckon, even in maths class, there must be something you can do outside the classroom that you can relate to maths. I think it's good to get kids out of the classroom. Just tell me this, Guangzhou, is there an airport at Guangzhou or you go back to Beijing or...
No, there's a huge airport at Guangzhou. I think they must have, because originally our flight was Brisbane, Guangzhou, Beijing, Amsterdam, but they cut Beijing out, I think, when the Middle East all had their problems.
Mm.
But this is a huge airport, and I think it's largely a hub for the industrial. So people who come here who are getting things built in China, I think they'd fly into Guangzhou rather than Beijing. And the Terracotta Warriors, I think, are close as well, so... But it's a huge airport, as big as Paris one. But, yeah, I think it's a lot more for the industrial hub and they're probably diverting flights into Europe here rather than Beijing because there's so many extra flights put on because of the Middle East problem.
Maxine, where are you from in Oz?
Sunshine Coast.
You'll probably be glad to get home, I'd say.
Oh, well, you know, I always think to travel. Hans Christian Andersen said to live is to travel. And I think so. But, yeah, look, it's Mother's Day.
But he didn't have to sit in airports, did he?
That's true. Or line up 15 times showing your passport. But, yeah, it's that's the tyranny of distance. And if you want to see the world, you've got to travel. But not everybody has the opportunity to do that, of course. But.
Great to talk to you, Maxine.
It's been a great trip.
Good on you.
It's all right. Well, goodbye.
Thanks for the info.
Catch you. All right. Bye-bye now.
See ya. Bye. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the studio this morning Helen Pitt, who's just written a book called Luna Park. Helen, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning, Macca.
It's nice to have your company. Luna Park, everybody knows Luna Park. And I was reading the little blurb. There was a whole lot of Luna Parks, wasn't there?
Amazingly, there were 8 Luna Parks in Australia, but many more throughout the world too. Like at least, 45 at least that took the generic name. But many of us in Australia think of the big two in Sydney and Melbourne, like the first one in 1912 in Melbourne and then the next one in Sydney in 1935. But there were 6 others throughout the country. There were 2 in Western Australia, 2 in Queensland and 1 in South Australia. So that's kind of what I wanted to look at, a little bit of the background to Luna Park and the two that we have remaining, but the one particularly in Sydney Harbour because I'm a Sydney sider.
Tell us about the name, Luna. Is that moon or what's the deal?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? The guys that started the very first Luna Park in 1903 in New York at Coney Island had a ride called A Trip to the Moon, and that was the sort of the main reason everyone went to it. But no, it was actually Elmer Dundee, one of the two owners, his younger sister called Luna Dundee.
Really?
And she was a champion whist-playing card player. Mm. And 37 at the time the park opened. She died at 40, not very long after the park opened. And then he died a year after. He fell sick on the anniversary of her death, and he died too. So it's interesting we all think of the name, and no one even knows this woman's name. And it's actually become a pretty popular name again.
Has it? Luna?
Yeah, Luna.
L-U-N-A.
L-U-N-A amongst a whole load of kids. And many people have come up to me after the book's come out and said, oh, I'm buying the book because it's my granddaughter's name. And so it's so interesting. You just assume, don't you, when you see that big, smiley, lunar-like, moon-like face, both in Sydney and Melbourne, that's where it's come from. But no, the very first one was named for Luna Dundee, who we don't even know much about.
No, and I've never, you bump into all sorts of people with funny names. Well, I do, going around getting different names, I mean, but I've never met a Luna.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we just associate, I think, with the amusement park very often or with the moon landing. But, yeah, they all took one. That first one in Melbourne was set up by Americans, and then the name was taken over by a Victorian convicted criminal to set up on Cottesloe Beach, right on the very beach that, you know, it was obviously the reason people came to Luna Park was because they were usually at the end of tram lines or at the end of a bus line. And this was right on the beach, and it got washed away in 1928 because it was way too close to the beach. So the third one started in Glenelg in 1930. The deeds were agreed upon the very month that the stock market crash came about. So amazingly, they operated for 4 years before the depression sort of bit and people were finding it hard to afford to go. Also, Sunday trading wasn't allowed in South Australia in that time. It's only recently been allowed. Yeah, so that was made it really difficult for the operators to turn a profit. So they packed it all up, shipped it to Sydney, and it's been at Milsons Point ever since in 1935.
Yeah, I was just saying that the local show, like the big shows in the, you know, Adelaide show or the Sydney show or whatever, and even country shows and regional shows, they always have, I mean, the great attraction for kids is the, you know, Dodgem cars and all the things and the Mighty Mouse or whatever it is. And that's what Luna Park has in spades. And even in this day and age when we're all on our phones and it's a virtual world, it's nothing like the rotor. All of a sudden, the floor gives way and people start vomiting. And
we call it protein spills at Luna Park. So it's not to avoid embarrassment from whatever may come about if you bring up your lunch. So yeah, you're right. It's like the permanent show. It's like the show that settled down all these amusement parks, and that was the very idea of them. They came out of the expo movement. Remember, we had Brisbane Expo in 1988. Well, at the turn of last century, or one before actually, 1893, Chicago's World Fair was really the template for amusement parks. It was set up so that you had a midway, which is the sections that you have all through amusement parks, pretty much like you had at an Easter show, and then or the World's Fairs that happened throughout the world, and then also many county fairs throughout America. So the idea was really to take that thing that was a moving and, you know, once a year thing and make it permanent. And so that's how we got amusement parks at that time.
And they were, as you say, they were a travelling show, you know, shows where, you know, they'd travel around the country with those sort of amusements, travelling show. But it's these ones, like in Melbourne and Sydney and wherever, stayed put. But showy people, they're different people too, aren't they?
They are. Well, actually, this one that was begun in Glenelg was one of the great showmen. He was a South Australian showman that went all around Port Pirie and Broken Hill with, you know, showing films at the time. So he was really well known on the show circuit. He actually began at Coogee Pier in 1928, which had a concession area of, you know, penny arcade rides. And so he went back to South Australia to work on this Glenelg one where he'd been from. And then when the owners said, you know, it's not working, we're going to take it to Sydney, he moved back to Sydney. But he was really one of the best known showmen around. And in fact, all the lunar parks, from the one in Melbourne, the ones that didn't end up going very far in Brisbane at Cloudland, the one at Redland, Redcliffe in Queensland, was actually started by one of the Worth family circuses' sons, one of the ringmasters. So circuses and showmen were always a part of the Lunar Park story, wherever you are, whatever part of the world. They were showy people. They needed those people to get them in the park. And then they usually had a business brain teamed with to operate everything, to make everything run smoothly, a mechanical genius too. Like we had at Lunar Park in Sydney, a guy called Ted Hopkins, who was a brilliant Mr. Fix-It, who was the one that got the rides tested and safely operating every day.
Mm. And the one in Brisbane was Cloudland. Was
Cloudland, briefly. So what happened? We had that one in Cottesloe, short-lived. Then when we had the South Australian one, it closed. In the late 1930s, we had two come to both Scarborough in Western Australia and Brisbane at Cloudland. And the one in Scarborough had a proper big face, like the ones in Sydney and Melbourne have, a big blue cement-rendered moon face, which if any listeners have seen it or recall it, I'd love to hear stories about it. And then the one at Cloudland was set up right at the top of the hill there, where Cloudland Ballroom was for many decades. And it had a scenic railway. It blew down before it opened up. And so then the US Army, when Douglas MacArthur came to America, he requisitioned that land. And that became known as Camp Lunar Park. So it was used by soldiers, given back to the people after the war, but the amusement park didn't really get off the ground like it did in other places. So because Philip Worth Jr., who was the son of the ringmaster, had a lot to do with the US soldiers, he could see that there was a market for this. So he took the idea to Redcliffe on the beach in Queensland and set one up there, which operated from 1944 to 1966. So they're really part of old Australia, Lunar Park, amazingly to survive.
And, yeah, I'm talking to Helen Pitt. She's the author of Lunar Park, and I'll continue talking to her in a moment, and I'll talk to you. G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, hi, Macca. Good to speak to you. I just wanted to let you know that we've had a masterclass on vaccination of older people here in Melbourne, and you may not be aware of it, but vaccination is the second most effective thing we can do to improve our health. So we've got 60 specialists from around Australia to get together and encourage them to be part of the push to get older people vaccinated. Many of your listeners will be older or have older mothers, and the greatest gift we can give her, our mother, will be to get her to get vaccinated, because it's such an important way of preventing disease and making sure that we don't become frail.
This is, you're talking about the flu or other things?
Yeah, well, the good news is there's two other vaccines coming on the market on the what's called the National Immunisation Program in the next couple of months, one actually next week, which prevent against a disease called RSV, which is just as bad as the flu and very common, and another one against a form of pneumonia. So it's really important that we get high vaccination rates. We've done a very good job with our children, but I reckon we can do the same with our older people too. And think about it. Have a discussion with your mother today. Is she up to date with vaccination? Because if you want to be around and avoid becoming frail, avoiding nursing home, vaccination is the thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. You're a professor, is that right, Michael?
Yeah, I work at Austin Hospital and the University of Melbourne here in Melbourne, and I'm passionate about improving the health of older people and keeping them fit. And as I said, vaccination is the one thing that can really do it. Not just flu, obviously COVID vaccines are still important, but these other ones that are coming on the National Immunisation Program, RSV and a pneumonia vaccine, they're going to make a big difference, because at the moment they're quite expensive or not available. But when they become available, they'll be essentially free. And we need to make sure they don't just sit on the shelves, but actually get into the place they're meant to be, into our older people, people over the age of 65.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a pushback against vaccination. I don't know why, but you'd have to deal with that too, I suppose.
Yeah, well, interestingly, older people pushing back a lot less. Surveys show that about 80% of older people are very happy to be vaccinated. The main reason people don't get vaccinated is because nobody talks to them about it, their GP, and increasingly we're trying to get specialists to talk about it. So that's why we had this group of specialists come from all around Australia, 60 of them, to hear for 2 days about the benefits of vaccination here in Melbourne.
That's good. So COVID is still around in some sort of form?
Absolutely. In fact, most of the people who are dying of COVID now, and there's several thousand a year, are in nursing homes. So it's important that we don't lose sight of that and get vaccinated ourselves before we visit older people in nursing homes, because otherwise we'll take the germ into them.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of things to think about in this world, but that's a timely reminder. And nice to talk to you, Michael. Cool in Melbourne this morning.
Yeah, no, it's not too bad. We're having a bit of a warm spell coming up, but not as warm as in some parts of the world at the moment.
So when do you think those vaccines will be available?
So the one for RSV next week, and the one for pneumonia, it's going to be given the name Capvaxive. It's going to be available, I think, in late June or early July, about that period. So both of them coming very soon. You know, when I started on this, there were only two vaccines that we could give to older people, the pneumonia vaccine and flu. Now we've got 6 or 7 very effective vaccines, and these are so important. They're second most important way to maintain health beyond clean drinking water for younger people.
Michael, great to talk to you. Professor Michael Woodward. Great to talk to you and good luck.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Helen Pitt. She's the author of Luna Park. Helen, what did you learn, do you reckon, from all your studies about showies and Luna Park and people's fascination with, well, hands-on, they're hands-on things, aren't they? People love to do dodgem cars or the rotor, and if people don't know what the rotor is, it's like a circular thing, and you back have your back against the wall and it starts to spin.
And the centrifugal force
keeps you at the thing and then the floor falls away. And people... Yep. And the rest is it. Then you have a protein spill. Is that what it's called?
That's right.
God, help me.
That's right. So you're absolutely right about getting kids out of school, because it's a very popular place to go, the rotor, because it does teach you a good centrifugal force science lesson. And at the end of school term, you will see the park filled with thousands of kids.
That's the way.
On the last week of school, doing a science experiment.
Physics,
it's very good.
We're
fun
having a physics lesson today at Luna Park.
And there's a proper school program they run, a school program. Well, and the kids love it. You know, it gets absolutely packed out. And school holidays.
And gravity, when you go down that big steep thing, gravity.
Precisely.
And you can work out, and friction on the thing down, you can work out the coefficient of friction, and
there's lots of things. Yeah. There is a lot of lessons at Luna Park, bizarrely enough. You wouldn't believe it.
The best way to learn about, you know, things like, oh, I've got to do science. I loved science, but and physics and things like that. Wasn't good at it, but I loved it. And that's the way to learn about it.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Well, I learned a lot about being there. Can I say, even just putting the amusement park together, having dissembled it piece by piece in South Australia and then putting it back together, I learnt myself. Like, I'd always heard the story that my uncle had worked on the Big Dipper. I didn't know he was one of the Depression era workers who put it back together again after having spoken to my cousin. You know, I just heard the family story. Our Uncle Fred worked on the Big Dipper. So he was one of the ones that helped piece it together. And because he was a mechanic, he got to test ride the actual little carts that they had going around the old first Big Dipper, which was an old wooden thing on Australian timber frame. And so it was just a lovely story to learn that Luna Park gave so many people in Sydney work, because it was right on the workshops of what was the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Exactly.
And they built it, knocked it down. It was vacant site, like just flat, weedy area. And so they got about 1,000 people to build it in 3 months. Now, that's a record, Macca. Like, you compare it to the Opera House, it took 14 years and $102 million, and the Harbour Bridge took 9 years and many millions too. But this took £90,000 and 1,000 people 3 months. Remarkable story.
And yeah, despite lots of trepidation, that's still there. Still there. And the one
despite huge tragedy. Yeah. We had a fire in 1979, I'm sure many of your listeners would recall. And it's been closed on and off for 17 years. But here we are in 2026. It's alive, welcoming over 1 million visitors a year, and has a beautiful backstory that's made it really an important part of the fabric of Sydney.
And you'll see that back here if you buy the book, Helen Pitt. It's called Luna Park, and you'll find that backstory. We did our program, didn't we, Kel, about 2 years ago in Melbourne, St Kilda that morning. It was a lovely morning, and as the morning went on, we could hear the mighty mouse going, and I said, can we stop that? But Helen, great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in, and yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Kerry Ferris says to me, was thrilled to hear the bit about Jack Sargent. solo canoe trip down the Murray River and Sparrow Force in Timor. As a child, I lived next door to Jack, his wonderful wife Kath and their kids. Jack had a pineapple farm beside our dairy farm, and Jan and I rode our bikes down a dusty road to Jones's Hill School near Gympie. I don't know where she is these days. I knew of Jack's amazing history and have seen the display in Canberra. There you go. Thank you, Kerry. Thank you. Well, people just about now be saying, oh, it's Mother's Day. Have you rung your mother? Have you rung your mother? Or they'll be saying, come on, kids, get in the car. We've got to be there at so-and-so because we're at the first sitting at the restaurant. That's what they do. They have two. Restaurant down near me, they have two settings in the day and then one at night. They're flat out. It's chaos out there. It's a jungle. Happy Mother's Day, everybody, and thanks for your company. Stay tuned on ABC Local Radio. Oh, Bree, you've missed out, doll. Bree will be here. I'll read her next week. There you go. I hope you enjoyed our highlights package. If you want the full Monty, listen in every Sunday morning from 5:30 till 10 and tune into Australia. If you see me on the road, stop and say g'day. Contact me at macatracks@gmail.com. Talk to you Sunday.